So what I want to do now is talk about that process in relation to a very particular case. So I say the case of the Bobbitt family and of what a member of the Bobbitt family that wrote Pandemonium was doing when he published that and other writings, and how that connects in. And the way I want to do this is in a kind of oniony kind of way, as in Peergint, to try and uncover, as it were, the layers of meaning that might go on around this text. Pandemonium, or The Devil's Cloister, and you can see the two rival title pages on the front page of the handout, and I'll go into the possible significance of the difference between them. What this text meant when it was published in 1684 for the Bobbitt family of the Somerset Devon border region who produced the text. Incidentally, I suspect that their name actually probably should be pronounced Bobbitt, because they're very often referred to as the Buffetts, in fact. And if you imagine Bubby Tracy in Devon, which is spelled B-O-V-E-Y, that's pronounced Bubby, I suspect they may be Bubbits, but I'll call it Bobbitt since it's come out. Ian Bostridge, in his book about the politics of witchcraft in this period, had already, in my view, quite rightly got to the heart of what's going on in this text when he wrote that Bobbitt was a writer with weak credentials, embracing witch theory with political ends in mind, as a cover for an attack on Roman Catholicism, showing that the iniquities of the Restoration Court and the advances of popery in the bosom of the English establishment were quite literally diabolical. So I can't claim to be that's going to be a core part of my argument. I can't claim to be the first person that came to that conclusion. But in studying that, Ian privileged one half of this book that's circling round over the other half. It's a book written basically in two halves. The first half, about 80 pages, is basically this long historical account of the nature of witchcraft and its association with idolatry and priestcraft, and that's what Bostridge focuses in on. The second half is basically a collection of stories about witchcraft and also fairies and other forms of the supernatural. And in fact, if you do the inevitable, which hopefully some of you do, go home and Google and put in Bobbitt and Pandemonium, actually the most frequent appearance of it now on the text is on a whole range of websites of people who like to reproduce stories of the supernatural, fairies, and so on. And it's gained a kind of second life in that respect, these descriptions of fairy activity and so on as part of a modern kind of pagan view of things. This second part, giving plain evidences concerning apparitions, spirits, and witches, proving by a choice collection of modern relations never yet published their real existence, as I say, consists of 15 cases, either from Bobbitt's locality, Somerset, there is a couple of Bristol cases in as well, and his own experience, or sent to him by friends, mostly in fact from Scotland. As I say, they've become part of a repertoire of supernatural stories. And there is another line of people with interest in witchcraft, including the Encyclopedist of Witchcraft, Russell Hope Robbins, and Montague Summers, the early 20th century collector of these stories, who by and large collected and emphasise that side of what Bobbitt was trying to do. Most people in recent times who focused on that second half of the book have attempted to associate Bobbitt in their mind with another Somerset writer, Joseph Glanville, the rector of Bath, a fellow of the Royal Society, who's famous for his collection of stories about witchcraft, which were then published by him and after his death carried forward by his editor, Dr. Henry Moore from Cambridge, particularly in a famous book called Sagittismus Triumphatus. And many people have said basically that what Bobbitt was doing was a kind of minor version of what Glanville and Moore were doing, and since Bobbitt was based in Somerset, they've essentially assumed that Bobbitt was essentially engaged as part of the same process. Essentially trying to collect stories and give scientific examples, as it were, of the reality of witchcraft. What I want to try and do is make sense of both halves of the book, try and argue that actually they are part of a coherent strategy rather than two apparently disconnected things to be viewed separately. I also want to consider the title seriously, Pandemonium. Borrowed, as I say, from Milton's Paradise Lost, where he introduces it as a term to describe the court, and significant to note the word court, of the fallen angels when the devil and his angels arrive in hell after their fall, as it were, and set themselves up. I also want to understand why there are two slightly different editions of the text reflected in the different title pages that you've got, and also what the relationship is between the account in this book of an episode with a demonic poltergeist appearance at a place called Sprayton in Devon, with another publication which came out the previous year called The Narrative of the Demon of Sprayton, which you have as the second page on your handout, and the fact that we also have another account of that narrative, the events described in that narrative, from a correspondent of John Aubrey, the famous natural philosopher, and of course writer of Aubrey's Brief Lives, from the same period. So again, I'll send those round as well. So I want to compare those accounts, and then I want to understand how I might see all these things actually fitting in together if we put them in the context of the experiences of the Bovet family in the second half of the 17th century, including the radical lives and deaths of Richard and Philip Bovet in civil war, under Republican and Restoration regimes, and finally in Monmouth's Rebellion of 1685. And then, to add an extra twist to the family dimension, the fact that the Bovet family then re-emerge as the victims, as they saw it, and the people who make the accusation, against a witch in one of the last cases of witchcraft tried in Exeter in 1696. So suddenly what has been a text, if you like, and most of what I'm talking about is a text, actually then suddenly breaks out of that and becomes an actual real witchcraft trial in which a real woman, as it were, becomes accused of these things. She's actually rescued by the fact that she had another sceptical royal judge at the trial who didn't believe a word of what was being accused against her, and in the context of 1696 he felt quite confident enough to lead the trial in a way in which she became guilty. And on the last page of your handout you have the description of that trial provided by the Archdeacon of Exeter in his letter up to his bishop describing what went on. Okay, so I just want to start with the point that, as I say, people have, just give you an idea of the complexities of what's going on. As I say, many people have assumed that Bovet, because of the second part of his text, is essentially working in the same tradition as Joseph Glanville and Henry Moore. And indeed, Bovet himself does everything possible to suggest to you that that is precisely what he is doing. He writes in his book, he dedicates it to Moore, praising with what irrefragable reason you have opposed and vanquished the legions of atheistical and disbelieving pretenders who seem to be incredulous of discourses of the existence of spirits and their attendance upon lapsed and degenerate men. He claims to be taking up the invitation in Sagittus Triumphatus to contribute all I could to the asserting the reality and spiritual existences of spiritual existences, and by consequence the advantages such subtle agents have to surprise the unwary and entrap the negligent disbeliever in inextricable snares, whilst they who shut their eyes against the belief of demons are imperceptibly hurried by them upon the unavoidable principles of sensuality and impenitence. And later he goes on with the various other quotes. I won't give you all of them, as it were, about that. And the narrative of the Demon of Sprayton, the pamphlet going round, which I also think was edited by him, carries on the same theme, talking about, again, the learned Dr. Moore, the ingenious Dr. Glanville, linking up with them in the idea that what is trying to be done by emphasising the reality of witchcraft is to emphasise the existence of a supernatural world against atheists, unbelievers, the hobbyists of the world, the followers of Thomas Hobbes, and so on. And that's Sadducism, which is being attacked in Glanville's title. He concludes, for example, that we have not room in this space to enter into disquisition of the nature of the apparitions hereafter mentioned, but shall for that refer the reader to the learned discourses of the Reverend Dr. Henry Moore and the ingenious Dr. Glanville, and so on. So it seems an open and shut case. He comes from Somerset, he's doing the same thing as them, he says he's doing the same thing as them, he must be doing the same thing as them. But perhaps not. There's absolutely no evidence that Bonnet had any connection whatsoever with the circles associated with the Anglican clergymen Blandell and More, who were in fact also Tory in their politics. Indeed, he admits that he's dedicating his book to More despite being a stranger to him. Apologising for his own unpolished discourse, he describes it as common prudence to list myself under the banner of so victorious a chieftain. And anticipating attacks for his work, he claims to have this further encouragement by I have not only engaged in a good design, but have put myself under the umbrage of so great a patron that there can be no apprehension of dangers from the attacks of the modern Sadducees upon, sir, your assured humble servant, R.B. This suggests to me that actually the appeal to the More and Blandell tradition is more a defence mechanism than an actual acknowledgement of authority. And actually there's some interesting subtle differences in the emphasis between More and Blandell, where the emphasis is very much on the religious danger, and what you may have noticed lurking in some of those bits that I read out to you, a theme in Bobbitt's work running right through about degeneracy, sensualism, debauchery. Those, as it were, are to him are the indelible associations of these things. And if you look at the title pages of your different editions, you'll see that kind of theme emphasised. And you also see the theme which, of course, Bostridge picked up on, which is the anti-Catholic, anti-clerical theme. One of the title pages describes this as an account of the idolatry of the ages after greatly advancing diabolical confederacies, with an account of the lives and transactions of several notorious witches, which the other title page then goes further to identify as confederacies of several popes and Roman priests with the devil. Again, Bobbitt's dedication admits that some may be offended at the method I have used in attributing to priestcraft so much of the original and contagion of diabolical confederacy. And of course, as soon as you go past popery into priestcraft, you're arguably not only critiquing, as it were, the Roman Catholic Church, but also maybe those Anglican clergymen and apologists, Blandell and More. So, there's more going on here, in other words, I want to suggest. Furthermore, in the balance between the two halves of the text, whereas most people, apart from Bostridge, have assumed that the first half was essentially a kind of derivative load of kind of polemic, and the interesting bit was the second half, Bobbitt actually makes it very clear in his text that in fact what he's really interested in is the first half, and actually almost as much as admits, as it were, that the second half is there to draw in his audience and get people to buy the book. And the really important bit is what he wants to say in the first half. And if in fact you compare Bobbitt's accounts in the second half of his book with those in Blandell and More, you immediately discover that in fact they're very different in kind. The average Bobbitt story is about one page long, is extremely general and vague, and does absolutely nothing, in fact, to establish any kind of scientific veracity to the stories that he's talking about. Whereas Blandell and More loves to, as it were, give detail, try and prove experimentally, as it were, that these things really happened. Blandell just tells you a story. Bobbitt just tells you a story for a page or two, and after he's told you that one, he goes on to the next one. And he himself admitted, in fact, that he knows that his readers might have wanted a lot more detail of the things he tells in part two, but he didn't have room in the book, because the important part was the first part, and he was damned if he was going to cut down the first part, as it were, to allow more space for the second part. Indeed, he denigrates the desire for more detail, not as the product of scientific interest, but of delight in the novelty of story. So he's actually coming from a very different setting. So, in my view, if we're looking for a true inspiration for Bobbitt's work, a much more likely answer is actually given by its title, borrowed, as I say, from the name given to the court of the fallen angels in Milton's Paradise Lost. We're now, of course, so used to the word pandemonium that we tend to forget both its original meaning, and in terms of the Greek it means literally an all-demon assembly, and that it was a word coined by Milton. And in fact, the Oxford English Dictionary has no other examples of the use of this word from Milton in 1667 until a text in the 1690s. It appears to have missed the title of Bobbitt's book. So, to use this word at this time is to line yourself up with Milton. And in fact, Bobbitt at one point in the text acknowledges his use of Milton when discussing the spread of idolatry amongst the Israelites. Nay, there was not any detestable idol among the heathens which never so bloody and diabolical did not at some time or other obtain for a deity amongst the hardened and backsliding Jews, a list of which is excellently drawn up by the pen of the learned and profound Mr. John Milton in his Paradise Lost. Reading Milton's poem, as in fact Milton, I'm sure, wanted his poem to be read, as a historical account of the interdependence of diabolism and idolatry, Bobbitt can clearly be seen as part of the radical tradition of reading Milton, which has been obscured for us, and really ever since the 18th century, by its adoption into the mainstream of literary culture at that period, and Milton being rendered safe, as it were. And I would refer you here, obviously, to the work of Christopher Hill and many others in recovering, as it were, the radical Milton, the Republican, the Regicide of the 1650s and 60s, whose texts of the 1660s can, I think, very legitimately be read, as I shall argue, Bobbitt can be read, as a long diatribe against the evils of the Restoration regime. Now, we have no direct evidence that Bobbitt knew Milton, except through the use of his title. But there may be a hint that actually they may have had a personal connection in one of the accounts in the second part of Bobbitt. Both the 8th and the 12th accounts in the book refer to a nobleman's house in the west of England which had formerly been a nunnery. Well, by my calculation, the only house that could possibly meet that description is Wilton House, the home of the Earls of Pembroke. In 1667, which is when Bobbitt tells us he was staying there, which is, of course, the year of the publication of Paradise Lost, he tells us he was staying there with some persons of honour, the significance of that I'll come back to later, and ended up sharing a room with the nobleman's steward, Mr. C. Now, you may not think that the Earls of Pembroke, by and large, as it were, are the most obvious radicals in 17th century England, although some of them were notable parliamentarians, but the fifth Earl, who was the Earl in charge in 1667, is a bit of an exception. The fifth Earl, Philip Herbert, had been a parliamentarian and president of the Council of State in the early 1650s, and although he survived the Restoration due to his immense wealth and aristocratic background, he was completely alien to the Restoration court. He had a reputation as a chemist and a mystic thinker, a Baymanist, and at the very least a sympathiser with Quakers. In fact, some people argue that he was a Quaker. In 1665, he went into the heart of the Restoration court to warn Charles II that the end of the world would come that year. Charles II, it had to be said, did have the better of this particular exchange, because at that point he promptly offered to buy Wilton House for a 7-year purchase, which, as he pointed out to the Earl, would be an excellent bargain, since the Earl didn't expect, as it were, the world to last that long, at which point the Earl retreated in confusion, and this story is picked up by the diarists and so on, and much enjoyed by people at the time. During the 1660s, the Earl was employing as his steward, in fact, the radical Baymanist Samuel Pordage, with strong links with Quakers and others, and the tutor of his children between 1665 and 1670 was none other than Milton's nephew, pupil and literary heir, Edward Phillips, to whom we know that Milton made regular visits during this period. So if Bobbitt was indeed a regular guest at Wilton in 1667, he must have known both Phillips and Pordage, and it may even be a reasonable assumption, in fact, that he might have actually had direct contact with John Milton. A less famous person that's also cited frequently in this text, and I won't go into this, but is a man called Daniel Grevent, who was a Huguenot refugee who'd become an Anglican clergyman, but who, in fact, published most of his works were radical anti-Catholic diatribes, not surprisingly, perhaps from someone of Huguenot background. And interestingly, in 1674, Grevent had published a work called Saul and Samuel at Endor. Now, you may know that the episode of Saul calling up the dead spirit of Samuel using the Witch of Endor is one of the main episodes in the Bible that has to be discussed by, of course, all witchcraft texts. And if you publish a book called Saul and Samuel at Endor, of course, you are appealing to a readership that's thinking it's going to tell you something more about that subject. If actually you open Saul and Samuel at Endor by Daniel Grevent, you find it has absolutely nothing to say about the Witch of Endor whatsoever, but is in fact a long anti-Catholic diatribe. Similarly, if we turn to the man who was at the very heart of the Popish plot going on in the late 1670s, early 1680s, Titus Oates. He provides the preface in 1683 for a book published by one of the two men who publishes Bobbitt's book, Thomas Malthus, called The Devil's Patriarch. And again, you think, what's going to come? Well, a full and impartial account of the notorious life of this present Pope of Rome, Innocent the XI. And then I haven't got time to read you the whole title, but anyway, ending together with the rest of the hellish policies and infamous actions of his wicked life, written by an eminent pen to revive the remembrance of the almost forgotten plot against the life of his sacred majesty and the Protestant religion. What I would suggest, in other words, is that we can actually see in a series of writers what seems to be, as it were, emerging as a trope in which you draw your reader in with themes about devilry, witchcraft, and so on, but what you actually deliver them is a long attack on popery, idolatry, and indeed the evils of courts. Now, I haven't got time to go into the detail here, but if you actually look at the two different editions of Bobbitt's text, and you look at the subtle variations in their title page, and you also explore the publishing history of the two people who published them, you actually basically, in my view, form the same conclusion, which is that in 1684, when this text is being produced, you have to understand that England at that point was undergoing what's called the Tory reaction, in which after the Rye House plot of 1683, Charles II's government is really cracking down on all forms of opposition and Whiggery, and there are a series of publishers being put under pressure from that, one of whom, Thomas Malthus, the man I just mentioned, one of the printers, in fact we know then fled from the country at the end of that period. But you can actually see that there is a strain of publishing that goes on, particularly through the year 1684, in which those Whig printers and publishers who managed to remain basically try and publish texts which get over a kind of Whig vision of the world by the back door. And I think that's what's going on in the Malthus edition of Bobbitt's work, with its title page, whereas Waltho, who was a much more mainstream publisher, who survived, as it were, and went on and became a law publisher, his title looks much more appealing to just a kind of general interest group. So again, you can almost imagine that the two halves of the book are actually deliberately and consciously trying to, as it were, to cut across two markets and leave the reader and maybe the censor and the authorities in a state of confusion about what, in a sense, this text is, and concealing from them, I would like to argue, its radical features. Interestingly, we know that Malthus fled England, quite possibly to go off and try and join in Monmouth's rebellion. At this point, we can go back to the story of the Demon of Spraton, published, as I say, by Malthus in 1683, by Bobbitt, and we can interestingly compare it with another account we have of the same episode, sent in the letter to John Aubrey, which you haven't got with you, but as I say, on that sheet, it was one of the things that I'm circling round. I won't go into the details of this story, again, there isn't really time to do that here. But the significant thing is that on the surface, if you read these two accounts quickly, you'd think essentially they were extremely similar, essentially picking up on the same sort of items. But once you start actually looking at them in detail, you begin to see differences. In particular, you see a difference in the emphasis within the Aubrey's correspondence about collecting, as it were, physical evidence of the supernatural events occurring. For example, an account referring to the fact that he's actually got a stone which was supposed to have been cursed, hurled by this poltergeist and hit the chap on the forehead. And he's picked up this thing and he says it's a very strange thing, it doesn't seem like any stone or piece of metal, and he's sort of wondering where this thing came from physically. Whereas there's none of that in the Bobbitt account, which is much more in a sense circumstantial. And then crucially, you discover in the letter written to Aubrey, which is written, it's rather confusing, it's written by one clergyman of the Church of England to a second clergyman of the Church of England, who then passes it on to Aubrey, and then actually tells Aubrey to send it on to some other people, including Henry Moore, in fact, and also, intriguingly, in fact, Sir Francis North, who it was thought might have an interest in this kind of case. So this, as I say, is an Anglican-derived account, very much the other one, and it actually contains a vital piece of information that we don't have in the Bobbitt account. namely, "Indeed, sir, you may wonder that I had not visited that house and the poor afflicted people, especially since I was so near and passed by the very door. But besides that they have called to their assistance none but non-conforming ministers, I was not qualified to be welcome there, having given Mr. Furze," and please notice that name, "a great deal of trouble the last year about a conventicle in his house, where one of the parish was the preacher. But I am very well assured of the truth of what I have written, and as more appears, you shall hear from me again." Now, there's absolutely no indication in the Bobbitt account, as it were, of that religious dimension. Bobbitt has completely suppressed the association of this account with nonconformists, because I would want to argue, to bring that out, as it were, would undermine the attempt to present this, if you like, in a, as a kind of part of an established tradition in that part of his book. So, whereas if one looks at Glanville Moore and so on, they are actually trying to walk, arguably, an ideological tightrope between Catholicism on the one side and nonconformism on the other side, and to defend the line of the Church of England and its beliefs. It seems to me that Bobbitt is unequivocally, as it were, associated with a radical Protestant, anti-Catholic, and anti-court approach, and that is what he's trying to do. And if one reads his text, it's very clear, as it were, that there is a devastating contrast being set out in it between the evils of the Restoration regime and the virtues of the period before the fall, which it's hard not to read, I think, as the period of the good old cause of republicanism. And at issue here for Bobbitt are both morality and religiosity, a simultaneous critique of both decadence and licentiousness, which both created and reflected a lack of proper religion and of a form of religion which was idolatry and priestcraft, not true faith. Both of these facets for him reflect the role of the devil in inciting such corruption. Forms of both behaviour, sensuality, and worship, priestcraft, which the devil has created and which led to his worship in place of that of the true God. Both the pamphlet and the book are obsessed with the bestial sensualities which would inevitably follow lack of belief in spirits or a future life. It's an eat, drink, and be merry culture, he describes, quote, "whilst with torrents of intemperate and libidinous debauches, they overwhelm their pampered and deluded selves in an eternal gulf of inextricable misery." Everyday night at Bristol, I imagine. "This world of licentiousness is seen as the product of constant falls from grace, in which the devils strive to seduce and draw off the subjects of the Almighty from their allegiance to their sovereign creator, and bring them into an estate of vassalage and subject to his infernal power." And just one form that that takes is the explicit compact with the devil made by witches, or what he calls those homages, offices, and oblations made him by his miscreant hags and confederates in their nocturnal cabals and night revels. But in fact, as the language of that expert makes clear, the Bobbitt witchcraft presents itself as just one form of a much wider tendency to false worship, confederacy, and revelling, all of which amount to worshipping that abomination, whether it be in pagan form or in temples and pompous ceremonies. And throughout the ages, what Bobbitt sees, and I think this is Miltonian, is a cosmic battle between a righteous seed and those still held captive in the chains of his diabolical enchantments and fascinations, notwithstanding the dreadful and terrible judgments of the Almighty. And he goes on about how the Jews did that, how the Christians do that, and so on. Ending, "still the old confederacy is kept up, though now under new forms and notions. And perhaps it is none of the smallest policies of the agents of that communion to impose upon their credulous ones the belief that there is no such thing as a witch, so that their performances of that kind may the better pass under the notion of a miracle." Now, when you actually look at what Bobbitt has to say about witches, it's actually profoundly unoriginal. In fact, it could be in any 17th century English witchcraft text. He condemns the full biblical range of soothsayers, charmers, sorcerers, and magicians, and witches both black and white, in other words, cunning folk and others who claim to fight witchcraft with magic as well as those actually practicing it. "Given the power of the gospel," he tells us, "in those countries where there is least idolatry and where the sincere preaching of the word of power is countenanced, it is very rare comparatively to meet with instances of the satanical craft and power." Again, a typical Protestant action. Witchcraft appeals to the ignorant, the malicious, and especially the superstitious, for they often become witches by endeavouring to defend themselves against witchcraft, while others take up the use of magical forms and symbols by tradition, as he puts it. He condemns the use of conjuring books and most judicial astrology, although there is a form of prophecy, he argues, that can be lawful and useful. God does give true knowledge of the future to such as truly fear him and call upon his name. Examples he gives of changes that may happen either to his church in general or to particular countries, families or persons. Approaching calamities often show themselves to us either in aerial or other prodigies. For example, the dreadful desolations that happened in Germany and in England in the late unnatural wars, which whether or no they were presaged by them, yet certainly had many tremendous apparitions in the air and on the earth, etc., before those calamities broke forth among them. The witch, in his view, is commonly understood, he tells us, as a female agent or patient who has become in covenant with the devil, having in a literal sense sold herself to work wickedness, such whose chief negotiation tends to despoiling their neighbours, persons or goods. In other words, Bobbitt describes the witch's relationship with the devil in terms of prostitution. Indeed, he says, those hellish compacts, therefore, are managed like the filthy intrigues betwixt a fornicator and his strumpet. But, on the other hand, and again, this is absolutely typical of Protestant witchcraft texts in England in the 17th century, he notes that because it is very difficult to prove such and such a one to be a witch, it ought to be done with the greatest caution. Some may have been unjustly accused for witches, either by ignorance of causes merely natural, or misapplying causes that in themselves are supernatural. In other words, nothing to do with a witch, it's God's direct action or whatever, especially given the possible effects of the imagination. But, quote, even if it be supposed that some have been suspected for witches barely for having deformed bodies, ill aspects, or melancholy constitutions, this does not disprove the existence of witches. That witches are commonly of the female sex, and again this is absolutely stereotypical, is explained by their Eve-like qualities, and, quote, it has been a long time observed that women excel in both virtue and wickedness, and that of course goes straight back to the Manius Manificarum and many other sources. Now, there is absolutely no sense in Bobbitt's book that he is actually seeking to stir up the prosecution of witches. He gives these, as I say, absolutely typical remarks and so on. But even though he tells witchcraft stories, he never pursues the question. He's quite quick to identify a witch at work. So his first case, which is from here in Bristol in 1683, although it's describing a case that took place in 1638, as a man who's written about a case he remembers, he puts at the end of the case, "There be no mention made of any suspected witch by whose power the aforesaid children are reduced to that deplorable state, and some of the physicians that administered them were of the common opinion that there was nothing of fascination in the case, but that it was purely the effect of a natural distemper." And then he goes on, "I must crave their pardon if I dissent from them. Many of the features of the case," he noticed, "were preternatural, unnaturally powerful convulsions, levitation, vomiting of pins and sudden recovery, and revealed, as he put it, the cloven foot of fascination." And he suggests that the omission of any reference to a witch appearing to the children might just be because no account survived of that particular, or because the Confederate agency might purposefully avoid showing any personal figure to them, lest the relations upon such notice should detect and prosecute the peccant party. Guilty, of course. Again, in the fifth case, which is a Somerset one, he notes that the suspected agent was a woman that had been of ill fame among the neighbours and suspected of diverse ill practices, and the problems began when she was accused of loan of some small change. A great toad and seven vast large cats appeared, and the fits of the afflicted mother and son involved vomiting pins and needles. The mother saw the witch and got her husband to cut at it with a sword, and then, and this is again typical of the cases of this period, that party, the accused person, had a lame hand for a considerable time after, although he notes that the supposed malevolent lived about 5 years after the person afflicted. Bobbitt notes again, "I do not understand for all this any justice was applied to, but many physicians, who all agreed it to be notorious witchcraft." And two of the Scottish cases he refers to also describe witches, although only one of them led to a prosecution. But interestingly, in Bobbitt's thing, although there's all this about witches, And although the first part of his text has gone on about diabolical things and rebels and confederacies and so on, there is actually, in Bobbitt's descriptions, none of the elaborate descriptions of Sabbaths or devil worship by the witches that you get, for example, in Glanville's accounts. Bobbitt says that, in this respect, Glanville was introducing into English witchcraft, which by and large before the Civil War was almost entirely devoid of any diabolical satanic activity. That comes in with Matthew Hopkins. It remains then after the war in the Glanville and other material. But actually Bobbitt has very little of that. Even though the first part of his text might have led you to expect that, his witches in the second part are actually very tame kinds of people. And even his devil actually doesn't really seem terribly devilish. For example, in one of his cases, which is actually the one to do with Wilton House, there's a falconer in it who's described raising the devil by reading a book at night. But when the devil actually turns up, he's called a frightful goblin. Somewhat bizarrely, and it's far from clear, in fact, how seriously we're meant to take the text. And there's another case in which he describes some maids hoping to see their future husbands on Midsummer's Eve night, which leads Bobbitt to discuss magical days and seasons, noting the devil's aversion to the light, concluding that it's most probable this appointing of times and hours is of the devil's own institution, as well as the fast that having once ensnared people to the... because it's Midsummer Eve fast... that having once ensnared people to an obedience to his rules, he may with more facility oblige them to a stricter vassalage. But he then leaves the learned to judge whether the appearances were the spirits of two young men, or, as he is apt to believe, spirits of another nature that assume their likeness. So he isn't pushing home a diabolical reading of these stories at all. And indeed, if you look at the Demon of Spraken, the demons he actually describes as ghosts, spectres, and spirits. And he actually admits, and this would have been against Protestant Orthodoxy earlier on, that one of these spirits came not upon an errand of uncharitableness, but to see the will of the defunct performed, which is actually remarkably like earlier Catholic readings of ghosts coming back, as it were, to carry out the needs of the dead. And his other stories, many of them are about preternatural poltergeist kind of examples, and as I say, a series of cases about fairies. And again, Bobbitt isn't really, he's telling these stories, he's not actually driving home a kind of theological or diabolical reading to what they're about, beyond the most basic sense there is a supernatural world, and you know, there's more to it than materialism. So, how can we then link the different halves of Bobbitt's text and link his publishing strategy to the life and style of his family? And I want to end by talking about the Bobbitt family and how these things link together. What I want to suggest is that what we know about the family offers strong support for the supposition that radical anti-popery lies at the heart of the book, but also suggests that a further motive for its publication, and in particular for the inclusion of the second part, was a desire to vindicate the gentility and worth of the Bobbitts. But I will also suggest that this doesn't mean, even with this in a sense very conspiratorial almost reading of what this book is trying to do, doesn't mean that we can rule out the fear of witchcraft as a real phenomenon, as a force driving the production of such a work. And that will take us back to the trial of 1696. So, who was Richard Bobbitt Gent, named on both title pages of the author of The Pandemonium? And please notice Richard Bobbitt Gent. Well, most scholars have followed Montagu Summers in assuming that this was the Richard Bobbitt Jr., born about 1641 in Somerset, who went to Wadham College, Oxford, and matriculated there, and who probably wrote two anti-Jacobite congratulatory poems in the 1690s, which are reproduced in the end of Montagu Summers' volume, and which indeed are radical anti-Jacobite texts congratulating William on his survival against the French and then against a conspiracy attempt, and sharing precisely the same kind of anti-popish, anti-Jacobite conspiracy theory of diabolism and so on. So it's perfectly plausible to read them, in a sense, the same thing. But it is perfectly possible that The Pandemonium was actually written by Richard Bobbitt Jr.'s father, possibly uncle, probably the son of Richard, but he could conceivably be the son of Philip, who together, as I say, were executed in 1685 for commanding a regiment in Monmouth's rebellious army. Both had been prominent parliamentarians in Somerset, where Richard briefly became the MP for Taunton in 1659. His purchases of sequestered property during the Civil War included the Duchy of Cornwall Manor at Milton Falconbridge, which he paid the amazing sum at the time of £7,150 for, so he'd clearly done well in the interregnum, and also from the Stowell family estates, a rectory and the mansion of Copplestone, outside whose gates, with the typical grim humour of Judge Jeffreys, he was hanged in 1685, which in fact for Jeffreys was a particular piece of grim humour, because actually he probably did it to spook out Lord Stowell, as well as it were, to punish Bobbitt for his audacity in having taken over this aristocratic estate earlier. After the Restoration, Colonel Bobbitt, or Bucket, was associated with numerous plots, frequently hiding before reappearing. Philip also remained a significant local figure, but was refused the title of gentleman by the heralds visiting Somerset in 1672, when he went along and tried to claim it, and he was disclaimed as no real gentleman. Now, these two Bobbitts were part of a Bobbitt clan, basically, most of them from the middling ranks of the countryside in the small towns, straddling the borders of West Somerset, East Devon, and West Dorset, exactly the territory from which Monmouth was to draw his rebel forces in 1685, and indeed Monmouth's rebels included 10 Bobbitts, from Yarcombe, Honiton, Axminster, Membury and Devon, and Stockford and Dorset, as well as from Taunton and Wellington, whose occupations were yeomen, combmakers, and an excise man. Only Richard and Philip were definitely executed, but three others were transported to Barbados, and one was reported slain in service. After that, the family then basically lapsed into relative obscurity. The clan leader, clearly, was that beggar old Bucket, as Richard Senior was described in 1685. From his rise to prominence as a parliamentary officer in the 1640s, and as a supporter of the radical John Pine, Colonel Bucket, as he was regularly known, was a rogue figure in Somerset politics. Say, a key figure in the 1650s with considerable power. He stands for election for the county in 1656, though he only gets 374 votes. He was a JP during the 1650s, and in fact, interestingly, his first attendance as a JP in Somerset coincided with the first witchcraft case in Somerset of a group of them in the 1650s, although there's actually no evidence associating him directly with any of them. They're much more associated with a much more mainstream, in fact originally royalist family, the Hunt and the Carey family, who were around at the same period, but Bobbitt had nothing to do with it. But whereas the Careys and the Hunts managed to survive the Restoration, with the Restoration Bobbitt lost everything. His properties were taken back, and he entered a twilight zone, in which he was identified, rightly or wrongly, in every radical plot of the 1660s and the 1670s as the potential military leader capable of raising thousands of soldiers around Taunton, which made it crucial since Taunton was the most anti-royalist town of the West Country. Time and again, he was Somerset's most wanted man and would disappear only to resurface when things calmed down. And I have to say, you read the story of Richard Bobbitt, you realise how radically incompetent Charles II's government was. So basically he couldn't remember, as it were, from 1 6 months to the next that he was the most radical man in Somerset. It's absolutely astonishing, but anyway. Finally, in 1685, his status was recognised when he was made a colonel again to command the Blue Regiment in Monmouth's army, while his daughter Catherine was the leader or captain of the famous Taunton schoolgirls who greeted Monmouth and who became the particular objects of both popular memory. And I'll circulate a song about them. This is a bawdy anti-Monmouth song in which Catherine's activities are described in bawdy terms. But there are also, as it were, positive Whig accounts of the Taunton schoolgirls as well, and the revenge of Judge Jeffreys. Jeffreys really went with the schoolgirls. So everything we know, in other words, about the Bobbitt family fits easily with the radical anti-popery and hatred of the Restoration regime displayed in part one of Pandemonium. But what of the connection of relations in the second part? Now, up to now, I've suggested to you that they're really a come-on, as it were, that they're there to get readers in, but they're not really important. But maybe they do also have a significance of their own. One way of reading them is to see them as an assertion of the gentility and importance of the Bobbitts, establishing their linkages with a range of leading families in the West Country. Presenting himself as the correspondent, confidant, and frequent guest of these families, the author presents the marginal Bobbitts, often as we've seen on the run from arrest, as regular members of gentry society, in addition to the noble family, and as we've seen it, those are the Pembrokes, that actually makes perfect sense. These include the Aishes of South Peverton, the Woods of Kitford, Sir J.F. near Sherburn, and several lesser but established families, as well as merchants in both London and Scotland. His Bristol informant, Mr. J.R., a gentleman of good ingenuity and reputation, was almost certainly, I think, Colonel John Lundy, a customs collector of Bristol, a leading radical involved in the Rye House plot, though he saved his life by turning informant. And the use of initials in this case, as also a 2C in the Straton case, you may see, as far as I know, wasn't Top Cat, and the coyness in naming the noble family, or discussing their cases in detail, quote, "I could say much more, only for the regard and honour I ought to bear to the family I dare not name them," seems to me to be playing simultaneously with two literary conventions. One, which has been widely discussed in the history of science at this period, is the notion of using unimpeachable witnesses from the aristocracy and the professions to give credibility to your testimonies, but avoiding compromising their honour through the use of social descriptions and initials rather than their full names. But the second convention, it seems to me, he's playing with surely, is the convention of the conspirator, who has to establish the strength of his potential connections, but without compromising their security. The bitter irony is that a year later, all these Whig and gentry families of the southwest sat on their hands during Monmouth's rebellion, leaving the beggarly Bobbit, as one of those radical families, the Cart family, described him, to lead the middling and lower orders of the region to disaster, execution, transportation. So it would be perfectly plausible to argue that for the Bobbits, as for the bookseller Malthus, the publishing of Pandemonium was shaped by the politics of anti-popery and the standing of the Bobbits, not by a desire to contribute to an intellectual debate on the world of spirits, much less to the old trade of witch-finding. Yet, of course, we need not necessarily conclude from that that the Bobbits were simply exploiting the fears of the country, exploiting a discourse, a literary tradition, without themselves believing in the powers of the devil or witchcraft. As I say, there's no evidence to link the Bobbit family with any of the Somerset cases tried in the period up to 1684, although Bobbit was certainly around, as I say, during those cases in the 1650s. But the story of the Bobbits and witchcraft does not end with the events of 1684-5. On the 7th of September 1696, as you can see in the final page, an Elizabeth Harner or Horner, though other accounts have it as Turner, was tried at Exeter Castle for killing Alice Bobbit by witchcraft and bewitching her sisters Sarah and Mary Bobbit. A man from whose account that is taken, the historian of Wellington, argues that this must have been a Wellington case because the Horners and Bobbits were local names, that you wouldn't try a Wellington case, Wellington being in Somerset, at the Devon Assizes. And it seems much more likely to me, given how the Bobbits were scattered through the region, that this is a case from East Devon, probably from Yarkham or Honiton, and indeed, the father, Thomas Bobbit, may well be one of those Monmouth rebels. It went on a bit longer than I intended. How do you want to do things?